heartache, and questions after Charleston. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama expresses sadness and anger after the mass shooting in Charleston, and he says America has to face it. Other countries don't have this kind of mass gun violence.
It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency.
We'll find out if the statistics back him up. Also today, the Pope's call to action on the environment.
I think the Pope is standing in solidarity with the poor and saying that their point of view on this has got to be recognized. And that is quite a radical message.
Plus, why it's hard to make a living as a female soccer pro and how soccer empowers girls in rural Nicaragua. That's all coming up today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We begin today's show with a story that's close to home. I'm talking about the shooting of 9 people in a historically black church in Charleston, South Carolina. A suspect is now in custody. We'll have more on that in a minute. Earlier today, President Obama spoke about what happened in Charleston. He said that he and his wife knew some of the members of the church where the attack took place.
And to say our thoughts and prayers are with them and their families and their community doesn't say enough to convey the heartache and the sadness and the anger that we feel.
The president then addressed the larger issue of mass violence.
At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency.
David Hemenway joins me now. He's a professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and an expert on gun violence. David Hemenway, is the president right? Are we off the charts on this in the U.S.?
Certainly compared to all the other advanced countries. If you look at the data, we are off the charts. I teach in a public health school, and people from other countries just can't understand why we allow this. For example, our gun homicide rate compared to the other high-income countries as defined by the World Bank is not like 2 times higher or 5 times higher than these other countries. It's 25 times higher.
We hear about Honduras, murder capital of the world. How do lower income countries kind of factor into all this?
We do well compared to some lower income countries, particularly countries which are in civil war. If you compare us to Jamaica or Mexico or South Africa, our homicide rates and even our gun death rates aren't that high. But it's just when you compare us to our contemporaries, basically the other high-income countries, the other first-world countries, the other advanced countries, that we are just off the charts. No other advanced countries allows this.
Yeah, so what factors play into this? Why are we more off the charts than Germany or France or the UK?
The big reason is guns. There's no evidence that we have more non-gun crime than these other countries, but we have by far the most guns, particularly the most handguns, and we have by far the weakest, most lax gun laws of any developed country.
Well, Obama also said today that it's in our power to do something about this. We heard the same after Newtown. We hear the same practically after every mass shooting. You've studied this for a long time. What can be done? What should be done?
Well, there's so many things that can be done. And the nice thing is we have examples from every other developed country, and there's all a wide variety of things. But basically, all other countries, advanced countries, have gun licensing, especially handgun licensing. Gun training. It's a very lethal product. You better be trained before you can have it. They have very much tighter regulations about background checks.
What do you think terrible events like this actually do? Do they change the debate? It doesn't seem to be a long change.
Yeah, one hopes so. In virtually all areas in public health, what gets people's attention is the catastrophes. Now, you have to realize here's a catastrophe that happened, but on an average day in the United States, over 90 people are dead from guns and hundreds more are shot and don't die.
How hard is it for you when you're trying to get this data, this information across every time there's an incident like this?
Well, the big thing is when people look at these numbers, It's just incredible. And you look at numbers, the United States versus other countries, you look at numbers, high gun states with weak laws against low gun states with strong laws, and the numbers just jump out at you. You can't look at these numbers and then pretend that guns are protecting us rather than killing us.
David Hemenway there. He's a professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and an expert on gun violence. President Obama also had this to say about the attack in Charleston.
The fact that this took place in a black church obviously also raises questions about a dark part of our history. This is not the first time that black churches have been attacked. And we know that hatred across races and faiths pose a particular threat to our democracy and our ideals.
Authorities say they don't know the motive of the 21-year-old suspect in the Charleston shootings, but they are calling it a hate crime. The suspect, Dylan Roof, did post a picture of himself online wearing a jacket emblazoned with the flags of Rhodesia and apartheid-era South Africa. Mark Pitkavage is the director of investigative research at the Anti-Defamation League and an expert on extremism.
The apartheid-era flag of South Africa has, in recent years, become a fairly common white supremacist symbol, and the flag of Rhodesia less so, but nevertheless a symbol that is important to white supremacists.
And so decode this for us. Why are they such powerful symbols for the white supremacist movement?
Both of those governments, Rhodesia and apartheid-era South Africa, were governments actually run by white supremacists. And they're quite symbolic as something that people could aspire to. On the other hand, in both those governments, white rule was eventually ended. That fact ties into a very common white supremacist belief today that the white race is actually in danger of extinction, drowning by a rising tide of color that is being controlled and manipulated by the Jews. And many white supremacists today actually try to claim that white genocide is taking place. And one of the common places where they try to assert that it's taking place is South Africa. And there have actually been, in the United States in recent years, rallies protesting this alleged white genocide in South Africa, held at different places around the country.
Right. Well, as you say, Zimbabwe, former Rhodesia. Rhodesia ceased to exist in 1980, more than a decade before Dylan Roof was born. Clearly, these symbols have a lot of staying power. Where else do you see these symbols, these flags?
We have actually seen white supremacists in the United States, as well as elsewhere, like Europe and other places, wave them as flags, as events. We've seen them turn them into internet graphics and use them, you know, on Facebook profiles or in other places online. You know, we see online stores that sell white supremacist paraphernalia. If you looked at enough white supremacists, you know, you might even find one as a tattoo.
Mark, let me ask you one more thing. Based on what we know right now about what happened in Charleston, it's very preliminary. I'm wondering whether someone like you who studies extremism refers to the Charleston shootings as a terrorist attack.
If the indications that we have so far from this obviously still developing situation prove to be true, that the perpetrator may be a white supremacist, we certainly would categorize it as an act of terrorism. All the common definitions of acts of terrorism, whether it's the FBI or Homeland Security or our own, refer to terrorist acts as violent acts committed in the service of a political, ideological, social, religious cause. And certainly the white supremacist movement is a cause that has generated a large number of terrorist acts in the United States over the decades. At the same time, it is also a hate crime, and the two are not mutually exclusive.
But isn't there a kind of a lack of consensus over that definition?
There may be a lack of consensus about this specific event because it happened less than 24 hours ago, and sometimes people have preconceptions about what an act of terrorism is or isn't, and some people may be motivated by that. But, you know, if this turns out to have been motivated by an ideology, it would have been a major violent act in the service of that ideology, and that would be terrorism.
Mark Pitkavage is a historian who specializes in right-wing extremism for the Anti-Defamation League. Today's the day many Haitians living in the neighboring Dominican Republic have come to dread. The Dominican government says it will begin to deport Haitians if they can't prove they're in the country legally. The new rule applies even to those Haitians who were born and raised in the Dominican Republic. Dominican officials say it's meant to regulate the amount of migrants coming into the country. Joshua Jelly Shapiro is with The New Yorker and is in the Dominican capital, Santo Domingo. He says the expulsions could come at any time.
There is a great deal of uncertainty. There's nervousness. There's worry on the part of people who weren't able to register that they will be deported. There is speculation that any kind of mass deportations or big numbers likely won't happen right away, I think in part because they're aware that the international press is here, the international community is watching. And there is, of course, a lot of doubt and worry among human rights activists and other interested parties about how this whole process will happen.
Josh, have you spoken with any Haitians who are in this bind, and what are they telling you?
Yes, I spoke with one man outside the Haitian embassy who said he'd been here for a dozen years, 12 years, working in construction. And he said he had been unable to get papers. He has two children here in the Dominican Republic. And he was just taking it upon himself to go back to his home in Haiti, which, you know, he seemed quite distraught about it. People need to either have a birth certificate from Haiti or a passport. Many of these people don't have those documents, so they were involved in quite an arduous process to just try and get some kind of paper that would allow them to register here and remain in the country.
So for that gentleman you spoke to, what does that mean for his life? Why did he go to Dominican Republic in the first place?
Many people from Haiti, of course, come to the Dominican Republic to find work. The Dominican Republic is a poor country, but not as poor as Haiti. The estimates are that there's something like 500,000 Haitians here working who may not be documented. So how this will actually happen in practice, I think, is really a confusing, because if they were to deport every Haitian who was undocumented, that would not be good for the functioning of the Dominican economy.
I mean, it sounds like identifying Dominicans of Haitian descent, how much Haitianness is in those people? That starts to be a pretty slippery slope.
Yes, no, it's an extremely slippery slope. You have many families that have people from Haiti or the Dominican Republic, and so that determining who is Dominican, who's of Haitian descent, is extremely muddy and tricky. And it's part of what's really worrying about how these deportations may happen. Often it just comes down to, you know, a rural bureaucrat or policeman deciding, this person has Haitian features, so-called. I'm going to look at their papers.
Why is the Dominican Republic doing this?
It goes way back into its history. The Dominican Republic declared its independence not from Spain, but from Haiti. There is a deep-seated kind of sense of Dominican identity that says that we, whatever we are, we're not Haitian. And there's an identification with Spain and with whiteness, no matter that the great majority of people are of mixed descent. But this relationship has been fraught and difficult for a very long time.
Joshua Jelly Shapiro with The New Yorker speaking with me from the Dominican Republic about the plan to start deporting Haitians who cannot prove legal residency there. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Marco.
Up next, the Pope weighs in on climate change on The World.
The World is supported by LegalZoom, for over 10 years working to help Americans navigate the legal system with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Pope Francis tackled climate change head-on today. He said it's time for a bold cultural revolution. Radical change, the pontiff said, is needed to escape the spiral of self-destruction which currently engulfs us. Pretty strong words there for the leader of an institution as conservative as the Roman Catholic Church. Here's The World's Matthew Bell on what the Pope is saying and who he's talking to.
Pope Francis isn't pulling his punches. He says humanity is trashing the environment and urgently needs to change its ways. On climate change, Francis embraces the scientific consensus that says the Earth is warming mainly because of human activity. His call to action comes in the form of a papal encyclical. That's the highest form of Catholic teaching from a pope. But he's addressing this one to everyone, literally, on Earth, starting with one group in particular.
He's very concerned about the poor.
Augusto Zampini Davies is a Catholic priest who, like Pope Francis, is from Argentina. Francis says that selfishness is really to blame for global warming, and he wants wealthy nations to take the lead on reaching a solution. Father Davies says this is the bottom line for Francis.
Climate change is affecting the poorest worldwide, despite the fact that they are not contributing to the world global warming. This really, really disturbs him. So what he's claiming for politicians is, listen, let's have a proper dialogue. Let's take this climate change as an opportunity to revisit our understanding of progress, where people can be included.
Beyond preaching about the Christian ideal of caring for the poor, observers say the Pope is also a savvy global politician. and that he's looking ahead to the International Climate Summit in Paris in December. Mark Hertzgard is the author of Hot and other books on the environment. He's also followed the Catholic Church for years.
I think the Pope is standing in solidarity with the poor and with the developing nations and saying that their point of view on this has got to be recognized. And that is quite a radical message coming in the lead up to the Paris climate talks, because that's not what you hear coming out of Washington.
American politicians may well be another important audience for Pope Francis. In September, he will speak to Congress, where most Republicans these days are doubters. And several of the top GOP presidential hopefuls are both Catholic and non-believers when it comes to global warming. Among them is Jeb Bush. He was asked about the forthcoming encyclical earlier this week, and he sounded unimpressed.
I don't get economic policy from my bishops or my cardinals or from my pope. And I'd like to see what he says as it relates to climate change and how that connects to these broader, deeper issues before I pass judgment. But I think religion ought to be about making us better as people and less about things that end up getting into the political realm. So I'm a little skeptical about this.
Those folks might not be persuadable anyway.
Mark Nugel is with the Catholic University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota.
There is a swath of Catholics, not only in the United States, but around the world, who will tell you that the Pope is right about everything except for the stuff that he's not right about.
But one group that Francis would certainly like to win over are U.S. Catholic bishops. They met last week in St. Louis. Christopher Coyne, the bishop in Burlington, Vermont, was there.
Unanimously, we're all behind the serious issues that he raises regarding the environment and God's creation. There were some concerns among some of the men, especially in some of the more conservative states, you know, the Western states and other places, that the topic of global warming was kind of a third rail topic for a lot of people in their states.
Coyne says a few bishops have received calls from donors threatening to stop supporting the church because of the Pope's position on climate change. But Coyne says he's read the encyclical and finds it hard to see how anyone could not be moved by it. Pope Francis must have anticipated a lively debate, and he seems to be saying, bring it on. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
That question of humans' relationship to the environment is as old as religion itself. After all, at its root, religion is all about how we should live our lives based on our understanding of how the world works. John Grimm follows the intersection of religion and science and the environment from Yale University, where he helps run the Forum on Religion and Ecology. How have other religious leaders in general been responding, Professor Grimm, to the emerging science on climate change, on how, you know, we're altering some of the most basic life support systems on the planet?
There have been a number of religious leaders who have made quite perceptive statements on the relationship of their religious traditions to ecological sciences and brought them forward in a meaningful way.
Mm. Generally, what kind of things do they say?
They're locating the values within the tradition. They're drawing on the, we might call it the wisdom of the tradition, in which relations between humans and communities and biodiversity have been understood as part of God's creation, to speak out of the Abrahamic traditions, and that in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, you find these powerful statements about these relationships and the responsibility of the human. And so that's what many theologians are beginning to retrieve within these traditions and use these to offer reconstructed theologies, or in the Islamic tradition, for example, fatwas or legal pronouncements that begin to talk about how animals should be treated, why coral reefs are significant for a community. And also, in 2001, 2005, my wife Mary Evelyn Tucker and I were at conferences in Iran that were focused on Islam and ecology, sponsored by both the Islamic Republic of Iran and also the Islamic clerics. So it's a new development in these religious traditions, and it's not the majority position in these traditions. But with Francis, this Pope, he brings the discussion to a whole new level.
Given that the three main monotheistic religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, don't share the structure of the Catholic Church with a single supposedly infallible leader, what is the influence of other faith leaders on their followers and others?
It's perhaps more diverse in the sense, as you point out, that there's no one central leader. But recently we received a document signed by 47 rabbis that were attending to the encyclical itself and pointing out that in their own tradition, they felt resonance with what the Pope was attempting to do in this encyclical. So that the diversity of schools and lineages within all of the Abrahamic traditions, it suggests that there will be a number of understandings of these issues. But that's also part of what I feel this Pope is trying to do with the encyclical, namely to make a more robust interreligious dialogue on the environment. And in that sense, it will be infra-religious also.
John Grimm at Yale University, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great, Mark. All the best now.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Making a living as a professional female soccer player is no picnic. One major factor, the super low salaries.
We got to find a way to provide for these girls that are playing professionally. It's pretty shocking to hear and see what girls are living off of right now.
And that's coming from a former top American player. Her story's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Time now for the Thursday installment of our week-long series, Teach Her. We've been devoting a part of the show each day to stories on educating girls and women, and we're highlighting schooling of all different types. Today, she shoots, she scores.
Rapinoe to the middle, run made, and there's one!
That was the moment Abby Wambach scored the winning goal for Team USA during Wednesday night's World Cup match against Nigeria. The FIFA Women's World Cup, hosted by our Canadian neighbors, is a prime example of how women's sports have gained a bigger audience in recent years. Joining me now is Leslie Osborne. She's a former professional soccer player who knows Boston pretty well. She played with our local team, the Breakers. Osborne's also played for the U.S. national team. And these days, she's an analyst for women's soccer for Fox Sports. She joins me now from Vancouver, where she's been doing commentary for the Women's World Cup. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me if this is a true story, Leslie. When you were 14, your dad made you put the names of the sports you were playing into a hat, and whichever you drew was the one you were going to focus on.
Yeah, that is true. I think it was my parents' way of managing their time and how they were going to be able to fulfill all of my commitments. Whatever I picked out of the hat, we would focus on that sport because we always had conflicts with swimming and running and volleyball and soccer and basketball. So my parents put them in a hat, and I picked soccer. So whenever there was a conflict, we always chose soccer. It's still a joke to this day that, you know, I should have chose tennis because apparently I was better at tennis at that age.
In any event, you chose soccer, the fix was in, and you played in college. At what point did you think that this could be a career?
Yeah, probably was my freshman year at college at Santa Clara University when I had one of the best coaches I've ever been coached by. And that was when, you know, he started to see it and I started to realize that, you know, if I really wanted to take this path, that it could be an opportunity.
You know, there have been lots of complaints at this World Cup that women haven't been given the same respect and playing conditions as men. There's artificial turf versus grass war going on. Where else do you see the gender battles playing out in soccer?
That's the biggest one. You know, the men would never play on a World Cup on turf. It's unfortunate that this one is being played on it. The positive is there will never be one played again on turf. So this is the first and the last. Other gender issues are, well, our FIFA president, Sepp Blatter, at one point wanted the girls to wear shorter shorts. You know, that's just unfortunate in some of the Latino countries especially. You know, women are wanted to stay at home and not be athletes and not encouraged to. And they're supposed to be at home cooking and cleaning and being a mother. And when you have people within federations coming and speaking up about, oh, well, the girls are looking better or wearing their shorts tighter, their jerseys tighter, you know, it's unfortunate. It's getting better, but there's still a long way to go.
So, Leslie, stay with us a bit, if you would, please. We're going to hear a story next about a women's team in Nicaragua where soccer is not the only thing that they're learning. Sarah Van Note has this story.
In the rainy mountains of Pangasinan, Nicaragua, a dozen teenage girls tear down an overgrown field after a soccer ball. Some girls are barefoot, a couple in school uniforms, and others in dark blue jerseys. Their team is called the Pearls of Pangasinan. Today they're playing a team from a nearby high school. Isayana Barreras came straight from exams to play in jeans and a t-shirt.
Lo que me gusta es que las chavalas me ponen de delantera y me gusta ir de delantera.
She says, what I like about being on the team is when I get to play forward. Soccer is an exciting sport, she says, and I like playing on a winning team. It's rare to see girls playing organized sports in rural Nicaragua because they have so many other responsibilities. Teenage girls are often expected to take care of younger siblings, gather firewood, cook, and clean. There's a small but vocal crowd supporting the team today, including a couple brothers and uncles. At midfield, Barreras maneuvers carefully in a tight group of girls to free the ball. And after a scuffle at the goalpost, Maria Hernandez scores a slow rolling goal, and the Pearls take the lead. Hernandez says, I'm super happy I scored a goal. It's my first ever in a game. She's only been playing a couple months, and she smiles widely as she chases the ball. Her toddler son wails from the sidelines. Hernandez is 22 and a single mom. She's had a life that's rough but common here. She dropped out of elementary school and lived most of her teen years confined at home working. Sports like this were out of the question. She says, I couldn't have fun or play sports because my family told me that if a woman went around like that, she was a slut, and that we were playing soccer just so men would watch us. A rogue kick sends the ball out of bounds, past a donkey grazing, and down to the river. Jessica Vilches whistles sharply and points to where to throw it in. Vilches is the Pearl's no-nonsense team coach and mentor. She says, we consider it a right to play soccer, that it's not just men who can play sports or have fun. The cicada buzz reaches its peak intensity in the late afternoon heat as the Pearls score the winning goal. They line up to shake hands with the other team and plan their next game. Vilches, who's 31, says when they started 2 years ago, male teams refused them practice time. Now the men ask them to join their tournaments, and most girls have the support of their families. They're making their own decisions to play, Vilches says, regardless of the limitations of society or their families. That's because being on the team isn't just about soccer. Each week, Vilches gives talks at her house on themes ranging from managing money to knowing their sexual and reproductive rights. Today, the Pangasinan team are gathered in a workshop with dozens of women from other communities. Then the girls make up skits, laughing at one woman's swaggering macho boyfriend, and talk about what healthy relationships look like. Conversations about sex are often taboo in the family, and sex education here deals with the mechanics of reproduction. Vilches says her talks are critical for girls to learn their rights.
Una chica de 12, 13, 14, a 15 años.
A girl who's 12, 13, 14, or 15, she's not ready to have children or even ready to enjoy her sexual life, she says. She needs opportunities to study and to set her own goals. Back on the field, single mom Maria Hernandez says her coach's talks have helped her a lot.
Mi familia me humillaba, toda la gente me humillaba.
She says, my family used to humiliate me, and other people did too. After listening to the talks, I decided I'd never let anyone humiliate me again. In their next games, the girls will face a new obstacle, the endless mud of the rainy season. But they say they don't care, they just love to play. For the world, I'm Sarah Van Note, Matagalpa, Nicaragua.
Leslie Osborne joins me again. She's a former member of the U.S. National Women's Soccer Squad, now doing commentary on the sport for Fox. I'm curious, Leslie, did you have helpful role models or mentors guiding you?
My sister was 3 years older than me, and she was a stud athlete, and I just looked up to her and wanted to do whatever she did. But it wasn't until I was 14 where Julie Foudy and the U.S. Women's National Team came through Wisconsin, where I grew up, to play in an indoor game, and I met Mia Hamm and Brandy and Julie after the game, and I started to really follow Julie Foudy, and I still look up to her today, and I think that was a turning point in my youth where I really realized, wow, like, I want to be like her one day. I want to be this great athlete, but more importantly, I want to be a leader, and I want to be, you know, this person that, you know, influences others.
So one thing that is tough for female soccer players is that a professional career can be short because players have to find, well, better paying careers. Tell us about your own decision to leave the game and, you know, well, find a better, more lucrative way to make a living.
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to play for the U.S. team right out of college, and I signed a shoe contract and had multiple endorsements. So for me, I had a really nice career for 10 years, and as a professional athlete, I saw former teammates retire and really kind of go through this painful time of not knowing who they are and what to do. We got to find a way to provide for these girls that are playing professionally. It's pretty shocking to hear and see what girls are living off of right now. It's not right, and I hope, you know, 5 years from now, you know, they're providing for themselves and having a better lifestyle than what they have right now. It's just pretty shocking to see what the women's game is paid versus the men's game, especially right now.
Give it to us in numbers. What's a typical starting salary in the U.S. Women's Pro Soccer League?
I would say an average salary is $15,000. The higher end players are getting paid 30, and the lower are getting paid 6 to 8.
It's barely minimum wage. How does that compare with the men's starting salary?
The lower tier players, I think, are getting around 45. So, yes, there is a big difference. In order for our league to work and last, U.S. Soccer and the league decided there has to be a cap on what girls can get paid. It is what it is, and it's lower than
floor,
the men's game.
Not a cap.
I know. And we're really pushing. Some of the women's national team players are kind of, you know, activists in this area, and I tried as much as I can and continue to try to be involved in any way I can.
Leslie Osborne, I would say former player, but soccer will always be in your heart, I imagine, when you've been on the national team. Now at Fox Sports and joining us from Vancouver in the midst of the Women's World Cup. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Our next story is about a group of women who are trailblazers, introducing a sport to a country that's never seen it. Marion Poiseau is a surfer, and she's a filmmaker. In her documentary, Into the Sea, she tells the story of three women working together to bring the sport of surfing to Iran.
This is an opportunity to write in the history books and teach the first Iranian women to surf. Today, surfing in Iran is born, and it's a story shaped by women.
Marion Poiseau joins me now from Biarritz in France, one of France's surfing meccas. I mean, first of all, Marion, Iran is not a country I or anyone probably associates with surfing. Where can you surf there?
We can surf on the southeast of Iran in a region called Balochistan, and it's close to the border of Pakistan. So that's the only place we can surf really in Iran.
Right. Balochistan, I've heard mixed reports about how safe it is there. What did you find?
It's meant to be very dangerous, but we found that the hospitality and the welcome of the people that, you know, really surprised us. So until now, everything's been really fine for us.
You go out into the surf, there's nobody there. That means there are not a lot of people in Iran who surf. How do you even go about finding Iranian women who might be interested in surfing?
No one was surfing in Iran before that, actually. We were the first one. And when the first time we went there in 2010, then I made a very short film of this story. I put it on the internet, and we had a lot of feedback from Iranian people, actually, saying, oh, great, you know, there's a surf in Iran. Then when we decided to go back and I wanted to make this film, Into the Sea, I searched on Facebook some sportswomen, Iranian sportswomen, and I found two of them. One of them was a snowboarder called Mona Seraji, and the other one's called Shala, and she's a swimmer. So I asked them, would you like to come join us and learn how to surf? And they just say, yes, of course we want. That's great.
Yeah. You hook up with these women who basically heard about surfing, seen some surfing scenes in American movies, but then they take to it quite well. They almost become ambassadors for the sport.
They were amazing. That's the thing with this story. Nothing would happen individually. It's a teamwork. Everyone's bring energy around it. And because we were this group, it worked.
Right. I have to ask you about the social part of the story. I mean, when the women head out to the surf, they seem to be wearing all sorts of coverings on top of the wetsuit. At one point, there's even a woman wearing like a heavy canvas poncho to cover up her wetsuit. How do you surf in hijab? I mean, is there a special neoprene wetsuit for that?
Until now, we didn't have really special wetsuit, so we just create our own suit, really. Like we had a hijab that we found on Lycra. It's quite slippery. We try some to get things so we can go in the water. But now I'm working with a French-Iranian designer, actually. We're making clothes for that so we can go and surf in better condition and respecting the culture.
In Into the Sea, there was a compelling interview you did with a cleric, a man who was talking about what it would take to kind of bend the theocratic law of Iran to accommodate more sports for women like surfing, which, as you say, doesn't allow for a lot of modesty. After meeting this cleric, what do you think is the biggest challenge to advancing surfing in Iran?
We have the support of the local community and also the support of the religious politic there. So no one really stops us to do it.
So first time that humans in Iran go into the water carrying these planks of fiberglass, colorful planks of fiberglass, what kind of looks did you get from bystanders on the shoreline?
Well, people were surprised, of course. Well, the first thing is, in the region, no one saw surfing before. So because we were only women in the water, they thought I was a sport for women. So the men asked us if they can also do it. That was funny at the beginning. The people that's coming, they come and said good feedback. Maybe some people don't like it. I'm sure some people don't like it, actually, but we don't see them. So all I can say now is all the people are coming and just very happy that we're surfing there.
Mariam Poiseau is a surfer and the documentary filmmaker behind Into the Sea, about Iranian women surfing in their home country. Mariam, great to meet you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Merci.
You can see photos of those amazing women surfers in Iran at PRI.org. Also, what amazing sport are you into? We want to see you in action. Just post a picture on Twitter with the hashtag TeachHer, one word, TeachHer. And coming up tomorrow on TeachHer, we're going to rock it out. No water in the water fountain. No side on the sidewalk. If you say, oh my hair, what you doing there? Nothing much to do when you're going nowhere. Woo-ha, woo-ha, gotcha. We're going to get the water from your house, your house. No water in the water fountain. Yep, we've got Tune Yards, we've got Angelique Kidjo, and we've got some killer musicians, all women, from Kenya and Mexico. Turn it up to 11 tomorrow on Teach Her. You're with the world.
Support for the world comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like physics, photography, and parkour. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Guns are on our mind today after the fatal shooting of 9 people in Charleston, South Carolina last night. It made me think of this story, which is also about guns, and about a huge billboard on the Mexican border at El Paso, Texas. You can't miss it. It's 70 feet wide, 26 feet tall, and it faces the U.S. side of the border. It reads, "No more weapons." But now that billboard is being dismantled. Monica Ortiz Oribe reports for the Fronteras desk at radio station KJZZ. She's in El Paso. Monica, first of all, just describe this sign. What's it made of?
Well, it's humongous. It's bigger than the 18-wheelers that are coming across the border every day. And it's pretty much situated at the gateway into Ciudad Juarez. It weighs 3 tons. It's made out of confiscated firearms. And it's something that's clearly visible from the U.S. side.
Right. So those confiscated firearms make up the letters that read, "No more weapons!" exclamation point. Before you tell us why it's being taken down, can you tell us why it was put up in the first place?
So it was put up back in 2012 by then-President Felipe Calderon, and his intention was to send a message to the United States. The U.S. is the main supplier of illegal weapons to Mexico. So the president wanted to send a message to the U.S. saying exactly that. We're tired of the illegal guns coming across our border and facilitating all this violence that has created so much chaos in our border cities and throughout the country.
So who decided to take it down and why?
Well, since the sign went up, the violence in Ciudad Juarez has been gradually diminishing. The murder rate went from an average of 8 per day to about 1 per day now. And the city has been working very hard to get back on its feet, revive its economy. And now the final element, the final missing element to the city pretty much getting back to normal is for American tourists to come back. That element is still missing. And so the current Juarez mayor has been making a multi-million dollar effort to make the city more attractive to tourists. And that sign, which again is at the gateway into the city, he feels is not appropriate and will scare off people. And so he wants to get rid of it and clean up the city's image.
So violence may be down, but do tourists really have nothing to worry about if they want to go to Ciudad Juarez?
No, I would say that basically there are still common sense precautions you have to take, but it's much safer, and the city is making a big effort to bring tourists back, and some are coming back, just like little by little, gradually.
Reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe in El Paso, thank you.
You're welcome.
A young singer from Nigeria has her own brave response to guns and violence. This song is written and performed by Nneka. I followed her career for a couple of years now, and I was surprised to hear what the song actually means.
There is a song that is called Pray For You that is about the presence of Boko Haram and forgiveness at the same time. Instead of being violent, instead of approaching the situation in a hostile manner, what we need is a peaceful revolution. What we need is change of mentality. So if I'm approaching Boko Haram, I'm not going to start cursing them out or judging anybody. I'll pray for you. You are killing me because you say your God is bigger than mine. You are killing me because you say your God is the major one and we all need to serve. But I don't think that my God is that God that you serve. My God is a forgiving God. My God is a loving God. I'll pray for you. You kill me, I'll pray for you. You shoot me, I'll pray for you. That's the way Muhammad would have done it. That's the way Jesus Christ would have done it. That's the way Gandhi would have done it. That's the way Martin Luther King would have done it. Yeah, and I choose that way. And many Nigerians choose that way.
So you speak with so much passion, Nneka, and that's kind of reflected in a post that I saw on Facebook from a woman named Sandra Isidore, who actually is the ex-girlfriend of Fela Kuti. She lives in Los Angeles, and a couple of days ago, having seen you perform there, she wrote, "Last night at the Troubadour, Nneka Egbuna killed it. This girl is truly the spiritual embodiment of Fela Kuti with her message delivered in that heartfelt way. Hashtag Bob Marley." That's just kind of mind-blowing. So what's your reaction to a comment like that from someone who knew Fela intimately?
It's nice. But Fela was also human. You know, it's a great thing to be compared to Bob and Fela in one person. Funny-wise, I do identify myself with both people. But I'm a woman. That's the difference.
Do you see yourself as a leader?
Yeah, sometimes, of course. Yes, I do. I actually do. But there's one thing that people need to understand. Even leaders have flaws, and even leaders need to recoup their energy somewhere, somehow. But yeah, I do.
What is your flaw?
My flaw is when I don't want to speak anymore because I feel too much has been said already and nobody's reacting or practicing what they preach. That kind of scars me, so I go into my funk, and my funk is silence. But then in that silence at the end of the day, I guess, I gained strength to scream again and sing.
Nigerian singer Nneka, we leave you with some more from Nneka's new CD, My Fairy Tale. It's a track called Local Champion. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can join us again tomorrow.
Some say I be gillish shit because I get wacky attitude for inside my blue. I no go like I try to adjust to your Oibo Lagos style, but I fail.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, Cindy and Howard Rachofsky, and the Billy and Dodie Crockett Advised Fund of the Dallas Foundation. By the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. By the Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today, annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.